from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Only the written word is the law. Those seven written words define Justice Neil Gorsuch's historic majority opinion on workplace protections for gay and transgender Americans. Quote, those who adopted the Civil Rights Act might not have anticipated their work would lead to this particular result, Gorsuch wrote yesterday, but the limits of the drafter's imagination supply no reason to ignore the law's demands, end quote. Now, this is a classical textual argument, but of course, what the law demands is also hugely influenced by the views of the society in which those laws are enforced. So Gorsuch's opinion says just as much about where the country is now regarding the extension of full civil rights to gay and transgender Americans. So this hour on Point, we'll talk about the Supreme Court's sweeping LGBTQ ruling and what it means for America today. And we'll begin in Belgrade Lakes, Maine, with Professor Jennifer Finney Boylan. She's a writer in residence at Barnard College and a columnist for The New York Times, where she writes about family life and LGBTQ issues. She's the author of many books, including her latest, Good Boy, My Life in Seven Dogs. Her 2003 memoir, She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders, was the first best-selling work by a transgender American. Professor Finney Boylan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, I'm Meghna. How are you?
I'm doing well. So first of all, when this ruling, the 6-3 ruling, came down from the Supreme Court yesterday, what was your first reaction, your first thoughts?
My first reaction was surprise and delight. And it occurred to me that I'd almost forgotten what it was like to get good news from this administration. It has been, as the old song says, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Mm. And yet here was this sudden burst of good news. And I just kind of thought, right, I seem to remember how to celebrate somewhere in my past. So it was a good day.
Yeah. So tell me more what it means for the LGBTQ community, because workplace discrimination, until this case was decided, or these cases, I should say, were decided as a group yesterday, was one of the places in which it wasn't clear whether or not civil rights protections would be extended to gay and transgender Americans.
Right. And it's funny that marriage equality, which is what we got first in mm-hmm. Obergefell years ago, was really not the first thing in the movement that LGBTQ people were fighting for. And what we were fighting for all along really was this, at least first and foremost, the right to be, the right not to be fired for who we are in the workplace. Marriage for years, I think, was just kind of off the radar. And yet it's funny that that's what we got first.
I want to talk about why that is in just a second. But if I can just jump in here, you saying that reminds me many, many years ago, I was frequently interviewing Mary Bonanno, right? The extremely highly regarded attorney who worked on marriage cases for a long time. And she told me then that really the goals were, first of all, protect people's families, protect them, their bodily safety and their families, then protect them in the workplace. And then marriage was this distant dream, as you're talking about. But the order has been all upended. And so tell me more about why that is.
Well, I think the reason marriage was the first thing that came through is that the argument that we should all be able to love each other was a pretty easy and strong argument to be able to make. And everyone, whether they're cisgender, whether they're trans, whether they're gay, whether they're straight, whether they're bi, everyone knows what it is like to love and to want to be loved. And so if you were to go, and I guess what I'm thinking about is the way the discourse when talking about gay Americans shifted from sex to love. Mm. And the ways in which gay people have sex and make love with each other is a topic that I think might have made some straight Americans squeamish. I'm trying to be delicate back in the day. And yet if you went to my mother's bridge club and said, who here is in favor of gay sex? Probably only one or two of those women might have raised their hand tenderly with a little bit of embarrassment. But if you said, who here believes that we should all be able to love one another? Everyone raised their hand. So the message among others, Lin-Manuel Miranda so eloquently and concisely said was, love is love. So I think that's why marriage was and wound up being the first victory. Equality before the law and protection in the workplace turned out to be the harder case to make. Although I think the Supreme Court is simply caught up with the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. But even among conservative Americans, most of them, I hope, have come to the point where we understand that people should not be fired for being who they are.
So that's one of the things that we want to explore in detail throughout this hour. But if you can stand by just for a moment, in terms of the legal arguments that were made, both in Justice Gorsuch's majority opinion and in Justice Kavanaugh's dissenting opinion, I want to just bring in now Greg Storr, who's Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News, and Greg joins us from Washington. Welcome to On Point, Greg.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, let's just get some sort of legal foundation set up here. This case had to do with whether Title VII of the Civil Rights Act would extend to gay and transgender Americans. What was the argument that Justice Gorsuch made in the majority opinion that the answer should be yes?
Well, the key words in this statute are that the law bars discrimination because of sex. And the key question was, does that include sexual orientation and gender identity? And what Justice Gorsuch said was, regardless of what people were thinking back in 1964 when the statute was passed, sexual orientation discrimination and gender identity discrimination are subsets of sexual discrimination. If you discriminate against somebody because they're gay or transgender, along the way you are considering their sex, and that's enough, because this is a very broad statute, and our job, as you said at the top, is to apply the law, and that's what the law says.
Well, if I can just read from the majority opinion here, Justice Gorsuch writes, when the express terms of a statute give us one answer and the extra textual considerations suggest another, it's no contest. Can you tease that apart for us? Because I think, you know, this sort of textual interpretation is, in terms of in legal circles, is the thing that everyone's talking about.
Yeah. And this entire debate, all three opinions, his, Justice Alito's dissent, Justice Kavanaugh's dissent, were all about textualism. That's the school of interpretation of statutes that Justice Antonin Scalia championed. And the debate among them was how exactly you do that when you have these words that were put into place in more than a half century ago. And from Justice Gorsuch's perspective, what matters is just what those words mean. And from Justice Alito's perspective in dissent, it was more, what did those mean at the time? And what were people thinking at the time when they put them into place? And they came to very different conclusions once they started from those different premises.
But Justice Gorsuch, in the majority opinion, seems to write that, as you're saying, it didn't matter what they meant in the 1960s, that you cannot view these cases without reference to sex. And that is why, for him, and again, just to quote, it's no contest. Is that what his textual argument is here?
Yeah, that is exactly his context. He says, look, if you discriminate against somebody, say a man who is gay, and you treat him differently, if you fire him differently because he is gay, along the way, one consideration has to be, he's a man. If he had been a woman and was attracted to men, you wouldn't have fired him. That's Justice Gorsuch's thinking. You know, therefore, that is discrimination because of sex.
Okay. And then in the dissents, though, is the concern amongst Justices Alito and Kavanaugh that they see this as an expanded view of the definition of success, and therefore they don't necessarily question that expanded view, but they question the court's role in it.
Yeah, they very much say, look, we are now, or the majority opinion now, is legislating. This is something Congress should have done. So they disagree with him on the way he interprets statutes. Justice Kavanaugh says we should not be trying to apply the literal meaning of statutes. We should apply the ordinary meaning of those words at the time. Justice Kavanaugh also talked about how by the court doing this, it deprived America of this moment where that he said probably would have come in the not too distant future, where both houses of Congress would have passed a law. You would have had a signing ceremony at the White House, and we would have seen, the popular will say we don't want this sort of discrimination. Instead, it was done by a bunch of unelected justices. That's the argument of Justice Kavanaugh.
Okay, so Jennifer Finney Boylan, respond to that, that Justice Kavanaugh is saying this would have happened anyway. It's best that it would have happened through legislation.
Well, I'm no legal scholar, so I'll defer to the experts on that. But I would say that in Kavanaugh's dissent, even in his dissent, he had a little rainbow shout out to LGBTQ Americans, saluting our tenacity and our dignity and the ways in which we have fought to achieve this moment, which I thought was really remarkable. I mean, it would have been more remarkable and even cooler if he had actually also voted yes on this.
Well, if I can just jump in here, I'm looking at that part, right? They, in Kavanaugh's dissent, he says, quote, they have exhibited extraordinary vision, tenacity, and grit, battling often steep odds in the legislative and judicial arenas, not to mention in their daily lives. They have advanced powerful policy arguments and can take pride in today's result. Under the Constitution's separations of powers, however, I believe that it was Congress's role, not this court's, to amend Title VII. So we're going to talk a lot more about the legal and the social issues surrounding yesterday's landmark decision from the Supreme Court. So Jennifer Finney Boylan and Greg Storr, stand by for just a second. We will be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the impact and implications of yesterday's landmark Supreme Court ruling extending Civil Rights Act protections to gay and transgender Americans in the workplace. I'm joined today by Jennifer Finney Boylan. Professor Finney Boylan is a writer in residence at Barnard College and a New York Times columnist, author of many books. Her 2003 memoir, She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders, was the first best-selling work by a transgender American. Greg Storr also joins us. Greg's a Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News, and we've got a whole bunch of other voices that we're going to bring into the program here in just a second. But Greg, I did want to ask you one specific question about the fact that it was a 6-3 majority. We're focusing on Justice Gorsuch because he's the one who authored the majority opinion. But should we draw any significance out of the fact that it wasn't, say, a 5-4 split?
You could certainly draw some significance from that. Why that happened is going to require some speculation. During the argument back in October, there were some indications that Justice Gorsuch might do this. He seemed very attracted to this argument that the text of the law required him to say that it protected gay and transgender people. Chief Justice Roberts, however, asked all his questions in the argument of the lawyers representing the employees, and some of those were pretty skeptical questions. And every time the Supreme Court has had a gay rights case that John Roberts has been there for, he has been on the other side, ruling against gay rights. So seeing him in the majority here was for me the biggest surprise yesterday. And since he didn't write anything separately, we could only really speculate as to what was going on there. But certainly seeing it as a 6-3 decision rather than as a 5-4 decision where one justice made the difference probably gives it a little more heft and a little more gravitas.
Okay.
So, Meghna, if
yes,
I could
ahead.
Just jump in here. Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing about this decision is that there were three cases before the court, two of which were about discrimination in the workplace against gay employees, and the third was about the transgender American. Mm-hmm. And so they could, and I think many people expected the ruling, the cases to be decided separately. But in fact, they grouped them together. And in the ruling, there's almost no difference in the way they treat gay people and transgender people, which legally is very interesting because it would be traditional for transgender people to be kind of separated and peeled off and treated differently. I don't know that this happens legally, but certainly in political circles, there's always an attempt to kind of use transgender people, since our issues are a little harder to get your mind around and since our numbers are fewer, to use us as the whipping girls and boys for some conservatives, and to embrace, say, the rights of gay men and lesbians and bisexual people in the workplace, but to hold transgender rights aside. That didn't happen. Mm. As you read the decision, it says gay, it's LGBTQ, it's everybody, gay men, lesbians, bisexual people, and transgender people. And so that's a big step forward as well.
Okay. Well, Greg and Jennifer, hold on here for just a moment, because I want to turn for a moment to Ed Whalen, who's president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a conservative think tank and advocacy group. He's co-editor of Scalia Speaks, Reflections on Law, Faith, and a Life Well Lived. And he clerked for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia between 1991 and 1992. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
So first of all, tell me, there's a lot of concern and consternation in conservative legal circles over Justice Gorsuch's reasoning in the majority opinion. Why?
Well, I think basically because Justice Gorsuch's opinion purports to be a textualist opinion, yet in the judgment of many of us, including Justice Alito in his dissent and Justice Kavanaugh in his separate dissent, really departs very far from textualist principles. Justice Alito memorably likens Gorsuch's opinion to a pirate ship that sails under a textualist flag, but actually deviates far from textualism. He separately says it's as though Justice Gorsuch thinks that textualists read statutes as messages picked up by a powerful radio telescope from a distant and an unknown civilization. Justice Kavanaugh contrasts ordinary meaning, which he says it's the task of textualism to discern, with some sort of literal or hyper-literal meaning, which he accuses Justice Gorsuch of relying on. And indeed, it seems very strange that Justice Gorsuch makes no effort to harmonize his interpretation of Title VII with long accepted practices that courts have across the country have regularly validated, including, for example, sex-specific dress codes. It's difficult to see how those could possibly survive under his test, yet he doesn't even address them. He just says those are consequences to be decided in some other case.
Well, you know, it's interesting because not only does he not try to harmonize, I would say in my read of the opinion, he doesn't see it any harmonization as being necessary whatsoever. And I mean, that's the specificity of his argument that I want to just ask you about here, Ed. I mean, Justice Gorsuch writes, the employers contend that few in 1964 would have expected Title VII to apply to discrimination against homosexual and transgender persons. But legislative history has no bearing here, where no ambiguity exists about how Title VII's terms apply to the facts. So he doesn't even see any legitimacy in the argument to begin with.
Right. Now, lots of folks agree with his principle about legislative history, but would say that his claim that this is unambiguous in the way that he sees it is utterly wrong. I mean, Justice Alito labels the Gorsuch position preposterous. So we have it's fair to say, a very sharp divide among the conservative members of the court, with the dissenters seeing Justice Gorsuch's opinion as a phony exercise in textualism.
A phony exercise? So help us understand what the perception of an authentic exercise in textualism would be in the context of these cases.
Sure. Well, you can see it in either Justice Alito's dissent or Justice Kavanaugh's. Again, Justice Kavanaugh draws a distinction between ordinary meaning and the literal or hyperliteral meaning that he imputes to Justice Gorsuch. Justice Alito likewise talks about what intelligent people would have understood this language to mean at the time that it was adopted, and says that no one would remotely have understood it to cover these things. Now, Justice Gorsuch, responds by claiming that the dissenters are relying on subjective expectations of the legislators, and they say, no, this is what ordinary meaning is all about. And it's you, Justice Gorsuch, who are engaged in this, alien exercise far removed from ordinary statutory interpretation that does not come close to engaging with what the ordinary meaning would have been.
So are conservative legal scholars concerned that maybe Justice Gorsuch is revealing himself not as a textualist? Because, again, I'm just looking at the language of the majority opinion, and he writes that the employers, he says they, but the employers seem to say that when a new application in this term, of the word, for example, sex in this term, in this case, when a new application is both unexpected and important, even if it is clearly commanded by existing law, the court should merely point out that question, refer the subject back to Congress, and decline to enforce the law's plain terms in the meantime. And then he says, this court has long rejected that sort of reasoning. How do you respond to that?
Well, look, he clearly is cloaking his reasoning in the garb of textualism. Whether that is camouflage for something else is the question in dispute. So, again, I think you have a real dispute here as to what textualism means in practice. And, my own judgment is that the dissenters have the much better of the argument. I think something that many conservatives find frustrating is that you have the liberals in lockstep signing on to a majority opinion that sets forth textualist principles that they don't actually embrace, and their own purposivism, would cut against the result that they're reaching in this case. So I think there's lots of exasperation on the part of many with the reasoning of the majority opinion and the positions of the justices in that opinion, including the Chief Justice, whose position here is very difficult to reconcile with his dissent in a same-sex marriage case, where he did not even address the argument that marriage law, as it defined marriage as a union of a man and a woman, constitutes sex discrimination. He saw that as not even having to be addressed. Yet the logic of the Gorsuch position would say, well, of course that's sex discrimination, and the question would be whether it could be justified.
Mm. Well, Ed Whalen is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a conservative think tank and advocacy group, and co-editor of Scalia Speaks, Reflections on Law, Faith, and Life Well Lived. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I want to now turn to Sunu Shandy. Sunu joins us from Washington. Sunu's legal director of the National Women's Law Center, which filed briefs in the Supreme Court cases that we are discussing. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I know that for some listeners, it might seem that we are wading deep in the legal weeds here in terms of textualism, et cetera. But it's important because the reading of the law is what we are asking justices to do here. So, first of all, Sunu, what's your response to what you heard Ed Whalen say, that he and other conservative legal scholars just see the majority opinion as a as an incorrect reading of the law.
Yeah, this was such a victory and a complete victory. And from Justice Gorsuch, who, in my opinion, didn't want to rule for LGBTQ workers, but had to, because that's what our civil rights law required. He interpreted sex discrimination to not exclude LGBTQ workers. And during the argument, it was so fascinating because he was worried about, quote unquote, social upheaval, or what is the impact of this, or this is such a big deal, a far-reaching decision. And yet he had to rule for the workers in these cases because sex discrimination is illegal. And at the National Women's Law Center, we know that sex discrimination means you can't engage in sex stereotyping. You can't say how people should present themselves in terms of their gender presentation. And there's no intellectually honest way to separate that from LGBTQ individuals or to exclude that subset. And so we were thrilled with this decision. Our brief was on behalf of women's rights groups. And I want to mention that in the dissent, Justice Kavanaugh had the nerve to say that Seneca Falls and Stonewall are different, as if our rights are not completely intertwined. And to that we say, no, this is the work of fighting sex discrimination, and it's all part of the same work for liberation.
Mm-hmm. So what impact could this decision have on other federal rules regarding gay and transgender Americans, for example, in terms of let's talk about access to health care?
I'm so glad that you raised that. Just on Friday, the HHS, Health and Human Services, released a rule that was trying to roll back civil rights protections for transgender individuals and others. And this victory really gives us additional strength to say that those rules are illegal. It also highlighted that these protections are real and not just sort of advocacy, but six justices on the Supreme Court say that we have federal civil rights protections. So we are very excited to see how this plays out in a multitude of other contexts, in the education space, in the healthcare space. And there's nothing in the decision that limits this to employment law. And as the dissent said, there are 100 statutes that talk about sex discrimination and forbidding sex discrimination. So we are thrilled to do the work of making that real. Now, the best way to do that in shorter form would be to pass the Equality Act. That would cement these rights across all of these necessary contexts and where there are existing gaps. But, you know, this is a case about economic security. Yeah. And here we are in this pandemic where women workers, people of color workers, are the ones who, while being essential workers, are also losing their wages. And this is another tool in workplace protections. And so we could not welcome this with more joy and delight. At the same time, the work for racial justice continues and needs to be done across all different strategies, including the legal work.
So just to be clear here, is what you're saying that these protections are automatically extended into all of those realms, or that it provides the precedent in which to argue that those protections should be extended in those other places?
I would actually, while it's not automatic, okay, it is very, very strong guidance for all of those areas, because when you look at the education civil rights laws or the healthcare civil rights laws, they all quote to Title VII. There are far more employment cases being brought. And so Title VII is really the basis that all these other contexts look to say, how is the precedent rolled out? And so it's not just another precedent. It's a very, very powerful precedent. And if I was running a school or a healthcare organization, I would assume that this is going to apply to me. Some may fight back, but we have sort of the power of the rule of law on our side now when we say that if you can't discriminate against people, that includes LGBTQ individuals, because that kind of discrimination is sex discrimination.
Jennifer Finney,
go ahead.
I was just going to turn to you.
Listening to both of these of your guests, it's amazing to me that we think of LGBTQ rights and humanity as political in some ways, that for some reason it's as if only Democrats are gay or trans or bi. And as I was listening to your earlier guest speak, if textualism had been used as an argument to to reject this case, he would be celebrating, I presume. What we know is that being LGBTQ is one more way of being human. The best known transgender person in the world is a conservative Republican, Caitlyn Jenner. There are millions and millions of queer people who are Republicans. And the idea that somehow conservatives feel that these are not their people is just kind of, mind-boggling to me. What I'm hoping is that conservative scholars can catch up with the rest of the country and embrace the humanity of all of us.
Well, Jennifer Finney Boylan, Greg Storr, and Sunu Shandy, stand by for just a moment. We've got a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the implications and impact of yesterday's landmark Supreme Court ruling extending civil rights protections to gay and transgender Americans in the workplace. And let's hear a little bit of reaction from attorney John Bursch. John Bursch is the attorney for the Alliance Defending Freedom, which defended the Harris Funeral Homes in this case. Harris Funeral Homes wanted to deny employment to Amy Stevens for being a transgender woman. And Bursch, in a press call yesterday, said he believes that the Supreme Court overstepped its bounds.
Biology is not bigotry, and that disagreement about what it means to be male and female is not discrimination. And similarly, in the same-sex marriage context, disagreements about what marriage means is true diversity. It's not discrimination. And so those continued discussions will play out in the courts and in our public policy arenas for years to come. I'm sure of that.
Jennifer Finney Boylan, can I just get a quick response from you about that argument that biology is not bigotry?
Well, sure, because it's as if these people don't understand that transgender people are who they are as a result of biology, and that if you spend any time at all studying the science of gender, you understand that sex and gender are not just about chromosomes. It's broadly understood that sex and gender are the result of many factors. And so we are who we are in part as a result of biology. I have to say science has never been a thing that social conservatives have ever been particularly concerned with. Or this administration, quite frankly. So if you want to argue that, if you want to argue about biology, you're actually supporting transgender people because there is a pretty wide understanding that we are who we are as a result of the way we are born and the way we have been made.
Well, I want to turn now briefly to Chris Hayashi. Chris joins us from Oakland, California. He's the executive director at Transgender Law Center, which filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court case we're talking about. Chris, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
And your thoughts when the court's ruling first came down yesterday?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a huge victory for the LGBTQ community. And also what I grounded in is the time in which this victory is occurring. So this historic Supreme Court opinion comes in the middle of an unprecedented global health and economic crisis due to our government's failed response to COVID-19. It comes during a time of an ongoing epidemic of violence targeting Black people in this country, most recently the police murder of Rayshard Brooks and the murder of a Black Lives Matter activist, Toyin Salau. It comes after a weekend in which we video surfaced where we saw guards laughing as Layleen Polanco died in her cell. It comes during a time of the ongoing murders of Black trans women in this country. Just last week, we learned of the murders of two more Black trans women, Dominique Remy Fells and Mia Milton. And we are in the midst of historic uprisings across the country. So this win comes during a time in which our communities are holding so much grief and so much rage. And we absolutely are pausing to celebrate together because as trans people, we do not get enough reasons to celebrate. And we also know that to make this victory meaningful, we need a continued emphasis on the safety, well-being, and leadership of Black trans people.
So talk more about that then. What do you see as the next important steps following this decision yesterday?
Yes, absolutely. You know, when this decision came down, I immediately thought about all of the trans leaders all across this country in small towns and big cities who have been fighting for our communities for so long. Black and brown trans leaders at the forefront, many of whom are not with us here today. So this win, we need to celebrate, and it is absolutely a call to action. It's a call to action for us to meaningfully center Black trans people's leadership and guidance. And if there's anything that shows us this, it's the massive march with thousands and thousands of people that occurred in Brooklyn over the weekend for Black trans lives that was led by Black trans women and femmes. Mm. I mean, this is a moment. This win is a call to action, a call for us to support and donate to Black trans-led organizations, to commit to follow the lead of Black queer and trans leaders, Black women, who are boldly leading and have been for decades, the continued call to defund the police and invest in community. Mm. If there's anything that shows us that is from our community in Minneapolis that shows us that we can win.
Yeah.
Last week, TLC joined over 150 LGBTQ organizations calling to defund the police and invest in communities. Mm-hmm. This win is a call to action for all of us who believe in justice.
Yeah. Well, Chris Hayashi, Executive Director at Transgender Law Center, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Greg, Jennifer, and Sunu, you've all been very patient here, and I really appreciate that. I want to spend the last 10 minutes or so of this show exploring sort of this where the country is now and how the Supreme Court may be reflecting that, right? Because that's part of the story here. And in fact, in order to do that, Greg, I want to actually turn to Justice Kavanaugh's dissent, right? Because he talks about the fact that he says that until the last few years, every U.S. Court of Appeals to address the question of Title VII protections has ruled that, the first 10 courts of appeals to consider it, all 30 federal judges agreed that Title VII does not prohibit sexual orientation discrimination. 30 out of 30 judges, Kavanaugh says. And then he goes on to write, "So what changed from the situation only a few years ago? Not the text of Title VII. The law has not changed. Rather, the judges' decisions have evolved." So talk about that. Are we seeing something that folks would say we've seen before, that the court following shifts in public values and opinions, even if, albeit slowly, following.
Yeah, it's certainly fair to say that is very likely a factor. The court does, at least over the big picture, certainly follow public opinion, and public opinion has shifted dramatically when it comes to gay rights, transgender rights. And I mean, you saw some of that in Justice Kavanaugh's opinion itself at the end of it, where he essentially celebrated the ruling, even though he said he disagreed with it. I do think one important point to make, though, is this fight is going to continue in the context of religious rights on the other side. Mm-hmm. Justice Gorsuch's majority opinion talked about how there's a statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. There's also constitutional considerations where you're going to have employers, including religious employers, who say, I have a religious objection to something. And the court has a case that's going to be deciding in a few weeks involving whether Catholic schools are exempt from discrimination laws of all types when it comes to teachers in their schools. We have another case next term that involves foster care agencies. So the pushback is likely going to come, and I don't know how the court's going to come out on some of these questions, but the pushback is likely going to come in the context of those employers who say, I have religious rights, that are on the other side of this equation.
And so what are some of the, so that's in terms of the religious side of this particular equation, but are there other cases that the court is considering right now that might also be this sort of Supreme's version of a mirror on where the country is?
Well, we are probably going to see. They have a lot of really big cases they have right now, including the case over DACA, President Trump's effort to rescind DACA. They just yesterday refused to take up some gun rights appeals. They refused to take up some appeals that challenged the qualified immunity of police officers, all of which are issues that are very much hotly debated right now. And, the court will undoubtedly, as it considers all those issues both now and going forward, be very mindful of the public debate. And in some cases, the court may say, as it did seemingly with the gun cases and the qualified immunity cases, say, look, we need to stand aside right now. Let that public opinion go forward. Let the public debate go forward, and we'll get involved at a later point, because the court tends to like to lag a little bit behind public opinion on most issues.
Yeah. So Sunu, talk about that, because I think we have seen that over and over again.
Sure. I mean, there's a couple points to be made here. One is this question of, could the people who wrote this law have imagined this? And what I will say to that is, things that are very clear to all of us as illegal now: sexual harassment, discriminating against mothers with young children, making women pay more for their pension. Like, these are cases that this Supreme Court in this decision refer back to. And these are decisions that are sex discrimination, that maybe the people who wrote that law thought were discrimination, and maybe they didn't. It actually doesn't matter. Same-sex harassment, illegal under these laws. So there's this question of, what did they imagine? But there's also this point of, that I loved in the majority opinion, where Gorsuch says, some did imagine this. Think about, for the last decades, the people who brought LGBTQ worker cases forward. I have to give thanks to my colleagues at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, where I was for 15 years. They brought these issues forward and said, as the experts on federal workplace civil rights laws, sex protections against sex discrimination include LGBTQ workers. So there was an evolution through the courts, both on gender identity and sexual orientation, and that was also helped along by federal agencies who issued guidance that also the courts look to decide what includes discrimination against sex.
But it's been
a process.
Yeah, can I just jump in here for a second? Because I completely take your point about this evolution in the courts. And at the same time, though, I come back to Gorsuch's own language, the line that keeps getting quoted again and again, that only the written word is the law. Okay, and he's talking about the law in and of itself. Certainly,
right.
that remains to be the primary and most potent area for political change, right? In terms of the actual word of the law or legislative change, as you know, even this week, conservatives once again are saying, if that's how you want to change society, follow that path.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what I will say is that even though we know that in half our states there are city and state protections for LGBTQ individuals, and so we know there's not this going to be this upheaval that he was worried about and he predicted and came up in the oral argument, even if there is that kind of upheaval, Justice Gorsuch knew he had to follow the words of the law.
Jennifer Finney Boylan, did you want to jump in here on that?
Oh, it reminds, I'm thinking a little bit about that quote Winston Churchill once said, that Americans always do the right thing, even if only as a last resort. And I think the Supreme Court is like that too sometimes, that here we are in this place at long last where, I mean, I think to many people, this case is self-evident. Well, of course you shouldn't be able to fire someone for who they are, duh. And yet it took all this time and all the work of the many leaders, including the Black trans leaders that Chris was talking about earlier. It took all the work of this many generations of people to get to this point. And how did that come to be? Well, in many ways, it's come to be because people have taken the risk of being known, of coming out, of being visible, and of living their lives out loud and without shame. So, you know, when I came out as trans 20 years ago, I think I had to walk around almost apologetically and explain to people and beg for their understanding. And, you know, my children's generation, now people come out and they don't have to do that. And they can simply be proud. They can simply be themselves in this culture without apology. Yeah. And so this is the power of being known. We move from a time when we can't even imagine such things to a time when such things and the humanity of people like me is self-evident. Mm. And yeah, I mean, that's really encouraging.
I also, this is Sunu, just want to say in terms of the work to come, we know that race discrimination has been illegal under our laws and national origin and color and age and disability and all of these other areas. That is the starting point. The work of this is to encourage employees to take these cases up, for attorneys to take these cases up, to have cultural support and movement in the streets, as we've seen in Me Too and now as we're seeing in racial justice. And so having this legal decision is one tool that we must use as we do all of our work for social justice.
Well, maybe you anticipated the question I was going to ask you, Sunu, is that what does this ruling not accomplish? Because you talked earlier about the Equality Act, and you're still hoping that that gets passed.
Absolutely. There are still gaps in the law, and there's still a need to cement these protections in education, healthcare, housing, in all of our areas of federal civil rights. And we also know there are gaps in the law. The National Women's Law Center is promoting a bill called Be Heard about getting over some of these hurdles, like the short window of time you have to bring a complaint, and this all these employers that are under 15 employees who are not included in our federal law, and all of these workers who are forced to arbitrate their workplace civil rights claims. So there are so many hurdles and barriers within the legal system that we are working to change on a policy level. What this gives us is one more tool that the federal civil rights laws protect LGBTQ workers. Now we have to go and address all of those other pieces as we've been doing.
Well, Sunu Shandy is legal director of the National Women's Law Center, which filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court cases we've been talking about today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Greg Storr, Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News. Great, Greg, it was great to have you. I'm sure we're going to want you back as these other big cases start rolling out of the court. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Jennifer Finney Boylan, writer in residence at Barnard College, New York Times columnist, and author of multiple books as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.